podcast with a K. So, it's the podcast with a K. I'm Christian Corley. With me this week are my best podcasting pals, James McLean and Brian Terranova. Hello, chaps.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. I just got to say, and this, you know, this means nothing to the listener, but I love your new photo on Skype, Brian.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, it's good. It's always good when people change the photos. You look at someone in a new way, or in your case, from a completely different angle.
I didn't realize that you had noticed. Gosh, thanks.
Yeah, and now I know what a small person or child would look at you as from the angle.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So, we are
mine
here.
Mine isn't updated. Mine's exactly the same.
Is it? How strange.
Yeah.
Mine isn't. So we are here to discuss, ostensibly, probably we'll discuss loads of other stuff as well, as you know how it goes with the podcast, okay, to chat about The Pyramid at the End of the World, the 7th episode of Doctor Who Series 10, which means we're over halfway now. And before we go on that, Brian, have you been up to something at the weekend?
Oh, geez, you noticed that. Yeah, I went to a local con here down in Florida called MegaCon. Well, I assume it. I guess it travels, but I don't know. I have no idea. I don't know if it's a traveling one. It was new to me because Florida is new to me.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I only made the one day. But yes, I was there as the 10th Doctor, and I met a certain Star Trek actor this weekend. You may all know him as Data from Star Trek. I know him as Brent Spiner because now we're buds. He fist bumped me and everything, both my wife and I. You know, we're pals. Yeah.
Yes, how was that? How was that good?
The con itself was okay. It was pretty standard fare for a con. It was pretty nice. Meeting Brent was awesome. It was one of those things where both my wife and I, we love him. Like he's our favorite Star Trek character of all time.
Yeah.
Data, that is, of course. Brent Spiner is just a cool dude. But we saw his line. It was Sunday, so it was the last day. The traffic in the place wasn't super crazy. But we saw his line was reasonable. Whereas generally when you want to meet a celebrity, the lines are like out the doors and so on. And then also the price was one of those things. It was like $30 to meet him. And I don't normally like to pay to meet a celebrity, but it was Brent Spiner and we both love him. So I decided, you know what, we came, we're here, let's do this. And it was hilarious because my wife was dressed up like Rick Mayall from Bottom.
Right.
I don't remember the particular episode name, but it was that one when he was wearing that devil outfit with the red pantyhose and the red cape and so on. She loves it. She loves the show. She loves Rick Mayall. No one she figured was going to even know who she was. And she actually did get like straight away. Some guy recognized her. So she was so thrilled. But when we saw Brent, he looked at me and he said, he's like, wow, you make a fantastic 10th Doctor, just an absolutely fantastic 10th Doctor. And then he looks at my wife and he's like, and he just kind of looks her up and down. Then he turns back to me, really a fantastic 10th Doctor. I mean, it was hilarious because she didn't expect him to know who that character was. You know, she didn't expect anybody to know who that character was, but it was a really funny interaction. But yeah, no, he was really cool. He was really fun to talk to. Very easy to talk to. As a matter of fact, he was the only celebrity there sitting in front of his table. So like you weren't allowed to shake hands with him, you know, as a pretty wise precaution considering half the people who go to a convention come home sick, which is why he was fist bumping people. But he was happy to pose and take photos with you. He was happy to chat with you standing right next to you rather than from across the table. So it was really, really worthwhile experience. And like I said, I don't normally like to pay for those things, but I'm really glad that I did.
Wow. Okay. So that's cool. So Brent Spiner, I haven't seen him in anything apart from the first Independence Day. Since then, I haven't seen him anywhere.
Yeah. I'll tell you what.
Unless there was a Star Trek film after that, in which case I saw that, but you know,
Did you see his, rather sort of self-facing web series he did a few years ago, which was really about him being a pathetic washed up actor who is trying to get on in his life. It was, that sort of thing. It was actually quite good. I only saw a couple of episodes, but it was, you know what I mean, that thing that sort of come from that sort of Shatner period of sort of self-mocking. And what he's done a bit in Big Bang as well, because he's been in Big Bang as well.
Has he? Right, okay.
Yeah. I'd seen a couple clips from his web series show, and not only that, I saw a couple clips from one clip from Patrick Stewart's new show or newer show, where he Brent was on there with him for like one episode, or at least the one episode that I saw, and it's really funny. He is really funny, and it is a shame that, like, you know, it's one of those sci-fi things where they're in Star Trek, so, you know, good luck getting extra work, you know, because he's good. He's really good. And also one of the things that we talked about very, very briefly anyway was his role on Night Court, which I don't know if you guys, I'm sure you guys probably got that over there anyway, but an 80s sitcom over here. And that was one of the things that he did before Star Trek. And I think he even did it while he was still doing Star Trek. And it was just, you know, it's an extremely different character to Data. And it really shows, you know, a lot of his acting chops, how versatile he is and so on. But yeah, he is still currently doing stuff and good stuff. It's just I felt like a loser a little bit going up and really only knowing most of his sci-fi work, basically.
Well, it's a convention, isn't it? I don't think there's too much to be ashamed of there. I do the whole thing of people playing themselves or versions of themselves has lasted far longer than anyone really expected it to, hasn't it? There's a new series at the moment, or it may have just finished, of The Trip. Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon doing hotel reviews and impressions of Al Pacino, for instance, or Roger Moore or whatever. And because the two characters are quite charming in their persona, in their, you know, their accentuated personas, it makes for, you know, you still want to watch it and still find out what they're going to do next, and find out if they're going to fall out, find out who's going to win the impression off, impersonation off, or whatever. But it's surprising that kind of genre of television, or that, whether it's comedy or whatever, or comedy drama, I suppose, in some ways, it's lasted for so long.
I suppose it lasts as long as people are interested in what they're like behind the scenes. While, you know, while we're interested in actors as people, as long as we're interested in people, I suppose that facade thing, and until we stop reading celebrity magazines and the ilk, you know, and disassociate our interest from the people behind, which we can't help, because like a magician, we want to know who's behind the mask. We all want to know who Spider-Man is, don't we?
Yeah, you know, but you know what? That's a very interesting point, because when I was a teenager and into all this stuff, I made a point, because I was interested in acting and I was interested in filmmaking, I made it a point to know the actors' names, to know how the films were made, to know the directors' names and so on. And a lot of people I knew at the time, just basically they wanted to know the character and they wanted to know the stories. But you're right. Nowadays it is like, everybody knows everything about the actor, and they're very much they're every bit as much a character as a character that they might play now. Fans know like far too much information now than what they used to. So
I think
I never really thought about that.
I think they're also sort of weird, like a discourse themselves on the character. People view them in relation to the character, and somehow they become a sort of meeting point. Sort of talking point between how they are reflects on the character you know them for. Because in the end, when those sort of things happen, it tends to be actors who exemplify a particular character, which has become embedded in that cultural memory, who is then reflected upon either by the audience wanting to see them being different or being the same as in that character role of themselves. I think that's what it tends to be. So you know, if you've got like, I mean, even people like Charlie Sheen, but he's not reflecting sort of discourse on a character, but more on his sort of media back, his sort of tabloid persona of being, you know, someone who's obviously into women and drugs and everything. So that was what sort of embodied his character in, even though he wasn't playing himself per se, he was playing a version almost of the himself as he's known in the tabloid, in whatever it was called, Two Men and a Baby or whatever.
Two and a half men.
So you get that. So I think it's weird, isn't it? There's loads to be talked about there. Probably
indeed.
Not about Doctor Who.
Well, you say that.
No.
But if we're to accept that the Truth Monks created a simulation of all of human history, then they've included all of that.
And this.
And this.
There's a downfall, you know,
according
to human history. So, well, one of those monks is having to go through this very tedious strand of podcasts, slowly pulling it down, looking enviously at the others as they're going through wars and tabloids and Trump, and he's there going through podcast with a K. Oh, I wonder what it'll be this week. I better be some more Moffat bashing. Yep. Why can't they give that guy a break?
So here we are with the podcast.
Yeah.
Okay. And well, the pyramid at the end of the world, big pardon, which I felt delivered some of the missing urgency and threat to the storyline, which was missing from the first episode. And the there's a lot of tech in there as well, which I think we'll come back to later on. But guys, I mean, James, you weren't too pleased with Extremis, were you? So how did this one switch things around for you? Did it work better?
I wasn't pleased at all. I keyboard warred my way through that week. I had Philip Bates asking for a little review, so again I was off for 200 words having a go at that poor episode. Yeah, it was better. I still think it suffers. I think there's a problem with Doctor Who, as we've said before, that it needs to freshen up. And I include the whole era, not just, this isn't a Moffat bash, dear monk. This is to do with Davis as well. There's certain sort of entrenched things which have sort of occurred in the new show, which just are old and just feel wrong. Things like having people of authority coming to meet companions, to me, just feels wrong. It just feels silly. It feels trivializes. It makes them feel like caricatures. You know, if someone wanted to go and have the help of Bill, they would send someone to go and collect Bill. They wouldn't go over to their house. You know, it's that sort of thing. It just sort of starts to. I could imagine Russell doing it as much as Moffat. So it's not necessarily things like that just weaken an otherwise quite strong story. You know, where you have to have all the leaders together again feels a bit. You know, I keep saying the show should be aimed a little more at children, but it doesn't mean it has to be childish.
Yeah.
And sort of having, you know, three people representing the nations of the. It's like, no. And I still don't buy this. The Doctor's the president of the world in times of crisis. It just doesn't feel real. I think the way Doctor Who works well is that he is that sort of subversive element which works underneath all the infrastructure. So you don't feel it sort of. It doesn't feel unreal because it never really deals with that infrastructure. You know, in the old series, not that I'm elevating the old series to being brilliant because at Time of the Rani bloody well wasn't, but it had those, you know, there'd be a call, the Brigadier would get a call from the Prime Minister, but that would be what you'd get from the Prime Minister. The Prime Minister wouldn't come round Sarah Jane's house or come over to even see the Doctor. You know, it removed all that sort of stuff. So it sort of became a sort of background, a background simulation, shall we call, monk, just so the monk who's listening to this or threading this knows what we're talking about. They're sort of like the background simulation to this virtual thing here. Don't need to be. And things like that just sort of bug me. I mean, otherwise, I thought it was quite good. I thought it was a bit of a shame we knew exactly where it was going. We knew eventually at the end that they were going to get consent one way or the other. And a smart guy would have probably predicted it would be Bill. Yeah. But. So again, and I think maybe 2 weeks in a row of that is a little disappointing, where you knew it by the end of it that there was, I mean, I don't know, people say, well, it's a three-parter, but even so, I think it takes a bit of it away when you know where it's going to go. You know how it's going to have to out its episode. And
yeah, I think a couple of things that you just said there, with regards to the Doctor being the president, if the Doctor's the president, why were they arguing with him?
Well, that's it. Yeah.
Well, so, that just, you know, it stops the whole thing working, doesn't it? I particularly did like. I really like the way that they narrowed down which lab.
That was I thought that was a really nice twist.
Yeah,
that was good, and I thought that was nice because we'd gone through the episodes. I'm sure most people watching it were thinking, "My God, something's going to happen very soon, and the Doctor doesn't know what it's going to be." Oh, God, you know, if only he had some sort of time machine where he could go, like, a little bit into the future. And, you know, I know people would say, yeah, but that future, like in Pyramids of Mars, would be a wasteland now. But those sort of things, I was surprised, wasn't just sort of noted, because I would have thought a lot of the casual audience would be thinking is, that why doesn't he get into his TARDIS and go and find out? But I'm kind of glad at the same time he didn't, because that was a really nice bit of processing, rational processing that got you to the point where they got to the lab. It was far more satisfying. Yeah, characters were
that
good.
That was a very clever bit.
The lab was great. I thought the lab set up, I thought that was all interesting.
The idea of a guy having a hangover being responsible for the end of humanity.
That sort of strikes an uncomfortable but realistic chime.
Exactly, it does. Yeah, totally.
So that was really good. So yeah, there was bits in it which were good for me, but just the whole framework felt old hat. I don't think you needed it. It's sort of like last week. I was thinking last week, the whole virtual simulation, if that had been, say, half the episode, and then they'd broken it and then had something else for the next half, that could have probably worked quite well, because that would have meant you'd had to throw out the Pope, you'd have thrown out the whole build-up, you'd have had the Doctor being told by someone about this book, and then he'd have gone and investigated. You'd have gone and done the bit with the Nardole and Bill going and meeting the people in the who are going to kill themselves. You could have had all that. You could have had the big meetup where the Doctor emails, and then you've got space to do something else for a bit, and then actually give something back to the audience before it finishes. And it feels the same with this one. You could have got rid of a little of that sort of dull build up with her back with a date, and then, you know, them appearing and taking her there, and the whole silly thing of the Doctor meditating. He doesn't notice they've actually drilled a hole through his wall and then yanked his TARDIS out, which in the new series is as physical as anything. I just, you know, it's just sort of, I sometimes think the show can be really good, and I think often this is when it doesn't have the luxury of a two-parter, getting to the meat quite quickly. Give it a two-parter and it starts to meander in these sort of, into silliness, not into better stuff, into silly bits.
Oh yes.
Yeah, and that's where I think the two-parters start to fail, or the three-parters.
Well, you know, you could, it's all in the writing and the effectiveness of the writing. And, you know, I think they want to have two-parters because they want to have cliffhangers and things. But, you know, one of the greatest cliffhangers in Doctor Who, as we said before, in Doctor Who Since He Returned, is the pre-credit sequence on The Unquiet Dead.
Yeah.
Which, whatever you think of the episode, that particular, you know, that pre-credit sequence and the quote-unquote cliffhanger there remains a memorable scene. This episode was written by Peter Harness and Stephen Moffat, and I think you can see the fingerprints of each all over.
Yeah.
Harness was responsible for the polite. the Zygon invasion, the Zygon inversion in the last series, and the slightly less popular Kill the Moon the year before. I think there's a quick reference to Kill the Moon in there, this week's story. And the Zygon invasion, Zygon inversion, there's a bit of a similar thing going on, isn't there? Because there's a poser. There's a challenge to humanity in it, isn't there?
Yeah.
The Truth Monks and their desire for consent, which again is something we'll come back to a little bit later. Sorry, it's not for me. And and you know, that's similar to sort of like the moral problems in the inversion in series 9. And then you've got the Moffat fingerprints, which is the silliness, the Secretary General of the United Nations popping down the bills, as you say. Doesn't even bring a cup of sugar. What kind of neighbour is that? And the wall being removed from the Doctor's study, etc. So, which is a shame, because there's some really good stuff going on in this episode, and I think the trivia kind of it detracts from it, doesn't it? Because you've got these really interesting, new, compelling villains, whose background we don't know, whose aim we don't really know, but assume that it's conquest, and looking at next week's episode, it would seem to be conquest. So it makes me wonder, the co-writing thing didn't really seem to go particularly well in series 9, so I wonder why they've continued it.
It feels for these 2-3-parters that the showrunner probably has quite, and for fair enough reasons, has quite a large input, because they're going to be logistically bigger things. They're probably going to be harder to sort of pull together. you're running two concurrent. They're not the same story, but they've got similar elements. But it does kind of feel that there's sort of these sort of standard structures start to be pushed into it when pegged in. And they seem to be ones that I know I'm saying that Davis would do, and I think he possibly would, but they're extremely inherent in a lot of Moffat's two-parters, especially in the last 3-4 years. There's a lot of feeling of that Day of the Doctor vibe, if you know, with the TARDIS being taken by helicopter and this need to find the Doctor and this whole thing of the... it's funny, isn't it? On one hand, Moffat does this thing where he wants to sort of make the Doctor an unknown element again. And he goes through this big process of doing that. And then he'll still run this thing of him being the president of the world. And
I know, I'm sorry, I'm with you. But he wanted to make the Doctor unknown again. And then in like the very next episode, he undid it. So he didn't even make it last long.
Well, he made it last longer because the... True. But then the Daleks forget him again, don't they, in Asylum.
Yeah, and then they remember him by filling in the gaps.
Right.
Yeah, so, you know, it's sort of backwards and forth, as if he has this thing where... I don't know whether it's something to do with the actual industrial process, where you start cutting corners because you're under pressure and these shows are inherently hard to make. And so rather than doing something different, like you're trying to do, maybe he's struggling because he would like to do the thing where the Doctor is a free agent. It's just easier in stories to not make him a free agent. It's easier. You have a situation where he's about to be killed. It's easier for him to sort of say, check on your data bank how many fatalities I've done, and make them get all scared because he's so powerful and run away. You get yourself a gag moment and you get out of jail free card very quickly for your character. So I wonder if it's that sort of thing. I wonder if it's a sort of sonic screwdriver of writing that, yeah, you could find more inventive ways to get things out of situations or to create situations, but these structures make it easy for the audience, easy for you. And that sometimes isn't a bad thing, but too much of it probably is. I don't know. I just feel the Doctor in all these stories since 2005 is still too big, isn't he? And that's the problem.
Yes.
He's still too big on every level. He's too big on a universal level where his fatalities rank so much that, you know, that various monks or whatever they were so so well trained, run away like girls. That's a really bad thing to say. Run away like girls. I don't know.
You meant children, didn't you?
I meant children, yeah, because I run like a girl. But point being, all girls run better than me. I don't know how you want to put it. But the point being is that, yeah, he's just too big and they never seem to narrow it down. I mean, that was the whole point of UNIT, was is that in a funny old way, when he was in UNIT, and I think it's why it worked, he was one of the team. They knew he was an alien from outer space, but no one outside of UNIT seemed to be really aware of that. No one in the hierarchy seemed to be aware of it either. So he wasn't like this great golden idol of opportunity. If something happened, the institution would reluctantly go to him because the Brigadier said so. So it sort of created that sort of Britishness, didn't it, in the show, that here was this massively powerful character that no one really knew about because the institution just really wasn't comfortable with it. And it would only reluctantly go to him when there was a problem. But now you've got this whole thing that he's such a big wonder. He is such a superhero that you do your bat signal whenever you need him. And the only time they did the bat signal I remember was Terror of the Zygons. And that was played off as a joke.
Yeah, but even then, too, it was a direct line of communication from the Brigadier to the Doctor. It wasn't See, the things that got me about this story, I agree, it was kind of like a step up from last week's, but it still had a lot of things pulling it down. The President of the World thing just immediately upset me because I thought you really needed to drop that. All those other things that we dropped to make Series 10 so much better so far, and that was kept. It was awful. I do have to bring up the United Nations Secretary General coming to Bill again, because not only was it, you know, when you do a joke in a TV show that works, when you do a gag that works well, and it works so good, you know you can repeat it, and it'll be a great gag the second time around. You can't use it too much, but you know you can repeat it and get away with it. The problem is that they didn't do it well the first time when they had the Pope interrupt Bill. It didn't work. It was too far. It just didn't sell. And now they do it again. Like you guys had pointed out, that the Secretary General came rather than sending some lackeys, some soldiers to go pick her up. But my point with it is a little bit different. My issue, rather, is the fact that they know, all the government, the United Nations knows, that Bill hangs out with the Doctor. So they know that they can get Bill and have her bring them to the doctor. Yet they don't know that the doctor, for the past 50 years, has been at the same school, in the same office, teaching the same lectures. You know. So they couldn't go to his school and just grab him. They had to go to Bill's house. Like, the scene could have worked better if it was soldiers, and they went and they grabbed Bill. They went and they grabbed the doctor. They went and they grabbed Nardole, and they brought them all to the Secretary General. That would have been a great scene.
Well, do you know what?
Here you would have had their lives interrupted.
I want to see an episode now where UNIT need the doctor, and then someone has to spend an hour trying to work out which incarnation of the doctor in which timeline they're allowed to call.
Yeah, right. But then, okay, but then the other thing is, too, what I love about the aliens is that they were opportunists. They were exploiting the situation that was happening on the planet rather than creating one themselves. You know, they were basically almost like the pilot fish from the Christmas invasion. You know, they were just hopping onto a bad situation and taking what they could from it. And I like that idea. But I kind of feel like the previous week's episode gave us CERN. And I said that it was a missed opportunity there, because rather than show that these scientists could have all found that, hey, we did dig into a parallel dimension, we screwed something up, they instead just found out, hey, gosh, we're all computers, let's blow ourselves up. You know, here this week, there's something that's going to destroy the Earth or destroy life on Earth. It's a bad situation that you need these aliens to save you from. And they still miss out CERN. Like, it would have been another perfect opportunity to use it again. Like, you thought to write them in one story, and then you still skip over it. It was a good idea that they had, you know, using this virus that would wipe out humans, essentially. Fine, I get that. And I like the fact, like you guys said, that it was basically because some guy had a hangover that he screwed up. But I just felt like there were a couple of misses, you know. But and also, one of the other misses for me was when it came down to the end of the story, and Bill has to give consent to save the doctor. It was an extremely predictable thing, and either it's extremely predictable because, you know, we're so used to storytelling now. I don't know about you two, or at least I am, whatever, but I know James for sure is. Christian, you probably already saw it coming. Or if it's just TV and movies just do the predictable thing rather than dance outside their comfort zone anymore. You know, they could have made something else happen. You know, I don't know. Some of these things just didn't work for me. Like, it wasn't a bad episode. It just had some things that just bogged it down from being a great episode. But I do want to mention one of the things that made me happy, and this extends even into the previous week's episode, not just this week's episode. I originally, if you recall, in one of the last two podcasts, I had mentioned that I didn't want the doctor to be blind for long. For whatever reason, I just thought that was going to be a storyline that was just going to be abused and left too long. But I have to admit, they used it well. I liked how it worked out. But more so, I liked the fact that it finally gave the sonic sunglasses some proper reasoning behind them. You know, I liked the fact that it was able to give him some limited concept of vision. You know, basically a Geordi LaForge concept from Star Trek, but with less ability to actually see. So I like concepts within this story. I like the base for this story, and I like certain aspects of how the episode actually played out. But there are just certain tropes that, unfortunately, they just fell into. And I'll put it to you this way. You, as you were saying, Christian, you have the two writers, and you said, you know, I wonder why, if it didn't work before, they went with it again. I have to agree with you, because it seems like when you're watching this story, you can tell which parts were Stephen Moffat.
I like the way you call back to Star Trek there. It's almost as if we don't throw the podcast together. It's almost as if we've got some sort of bizarre script.
Right. It's listen, hilarious, too. Yeah.
Yeah. A couple of years ago, there was an international incident with relation to an international terror group. And subsequently, there was an episode of Doctor Who that had some changes made to it, which I think was Robots of Sherwood. The same is true of the pyramid at the end of the world. And I mention this because there was we had a conversation about it following Robots of Sherwood. And the conversation should probably have a small additional chapter or perhaps just an epilogue. Because there's obviously the issue of sensitivity in the BBC. You don't want to upset anybody watching Doctor Who and having a mention of terrorism. But at the same time, it happens almost daily around the world, and it seems odd for a show that is shipped internationally to make that type of edit, because if it wasn't suitable to be left in, then it probably wasn't suitable to be included in the initial script, in my opinion. So I do find it to be, it does seem to just smack of short-termism. And I hate to say this, but it also does sound like it's a way of getting column inches and promotion for the show. That's how it feels. It does feel a little bit cynical to me. I don't know what you guys think.
It's a difficult one. I mean, I at the time did agree with you with robots, and I still do to a degree, and I do partially agree with you on this as well. At the same time, you know, I was talking to one of my family who came from Manchester, where the situation which you're referring to has taken place of late, and they were, even though she hasn't been in Manchester, hasn't lived there for like 40 years, she still felt an extreme sadness and pain over this in a way that I don't, probably because I've moved around a lot. I don't have that kinship to any religion, and I don't know whether, from my point of view, is that, yeah, I kind of feel that you don't censor shows for topical events, because then do you have the question of, do you censor a show as soon as there's a car crash, because there'll be someone who will be profoundly affected because they've lost a loved one in a car crash or a suicide or a drug abuse or a murder? You know, how far, you know, do you have to play a total level playing field, or do you select what you consider to be the most pain? And I suppose from the position of the BBC, it's not actually responding to the pain. It's responding to a sort of a larger gestalt, like people like my mother, who never would complain, but felt profoundly connected to the situation in that particular region, even though she wasn't there. So I suppose they're responding not to the fact that people will be upset by it, maybe by the fact that people, it might reflect on sensitivities that people would rather not be thinking about at that time, even though they might not actually have been directly involved in it. So maybe it has a wider, more dispersed rationale behind it. I don't know. Like I say, with robots, I totally agree with you. And right now, I don't personally disagree with you for my personal feelings. But I wonder if that's something to do with it, something that I don't quite understand. They have to be more...
Was something cut from the Zygon one as well?
I have no idea.
I don't recall that.
I'm not
maybe
sure.
There was, maybe there wasn't. But it seems to me like... this is something that they've done before, and they've kind of, I don't know, it just seems like something to include something like that might be seen as crass anyway. So to then find real world events catching up with you, it seems like something they could have avoided. Sorry, go on.
No, you're fine. I'm cutting you off. I'm sorry about that. But no, I'm thinking, like, I'm of two minds about this, because on one hand, I feel if the comments within the show are kind of... talking about it as sort of a warning, or talking about it in a poor light, like obviously the way that we would, like it's a disgusting thing, it's a terrible thing that happened. If they're mentioning that in the story, like that this is a horrible thing, you know, you're essentially akin to that or whatever, I personally don't see a problem with that. I don't see why that's so bad. But then the other, it all depends on how the comment was said, I guess, of course. But the other side of it is, why does it reach the news that the show had a line that is getting cut out? You know, to me, it should be that if it's a respect thing, we're cutting it out because we think it might upset people, then cut it out and don't mention it and don't put it in the news. Now, granted, I understand that some places like the Mirror, they're going to get their rumors and they're going to roll with it and stuff's going to get out. But why don't make an official statement? Don't make anything official. You think you have something in there that's going to offend? Take it out, air the episode. No one ever needs to know that it was going to be in there. No one ever needs to know that there was something to think about or to wonder. Because another part of me thinks anybody that has been affected by that tragedy, and I don't even think you need to be personally connected to anyone in that to be affected by that tragedy. Mm-hmm. You're going to be watching the episode, sitting there going, was this the scene where that line would have been? I wonder what it would have been. Would they have said this? Would they have said that? Because now they're thinking too much about it rather than thinking nothing about it if they knew if they never knew that it was there.
Well, like you say, is it just simply a political thing where they know there is a lot of political agendas going on at the moment with the BBC and media agendas as well, that they're just covering their bases? That if they didn't, would they be attacked for not doing anything about it and being insensitive to the, you know, is it just, as you say, a bit of
maybe it was simply political with it being the election?
Well, it could have also simply been, if we don't say something about it, someone's going to find out and they're going to post about it. So why don't we nip it in the bud and take responsibility for it? Yeah. And that makes a lot of sense, you know, because you don't, especially if it's a sensitive nature, you don't want a third party coming out with that information before you. And I guess that makes sense. I don't know. It's just a shame. To be honest, I wonder if an episode, if they, whatever the line was, if they had left it in, I wonder how much backlash there would have actually been for it. Or even the same thing with the Robots of Sherwood. You know, because if you're watching a particular type of TV show like this, certainly the Robots of Sherwood storyline, and having a beheading within that episode wouldn't have been out of the realm of possibility, especially since, if I'm not mistaken, that character was a robot anyway. You know, and then what made it okay, basically, to get to the Husbands of River Song and show that Nardole had been beheaded? You know, like, why was it that it wasn't okay to do it because there was a recent situation, but, you know, it's okay now that time has passed? You know, that's what I don't get about this stuff. It should just be okay or not okay in my eyes.
Yeah,
and maybe I'm seeing it too black and white, but that's just how I feel.
Let's move on and possibly hopefully close that chapter for the responsible storytelling in future on Doctor Who. Let's get social. Facebook, Jonathan Roberts on the matter of the pyramid at the end of the world tells us that the story was okay and he liked the character of Erica. She thought she was fab. She's proved to be quite a popular character. Erica, played by an actress called Rachel Denning, who I think I've seen in a few other things before, but I'm afraid I couldn't put a name to any of them. Samuel Grieve said it made last week's feel even more irrelevant than it did at the time. This week was fine, though felt very Moffat. So, I think that's similar to what you said.
I want to go back to that last comment because it is amazing when you think about it how much this week's story didn't need last week's episode.
Mm. Mm. No, you're right. Yeah. It could have been compressed into like 10 minutes, couldn't it?
It could have been, but you don't even need it. Like, think about it. A mysterious pyramid shows up and then, you know, you're going to meet these monks. They're going to come tell you what they want anyway. The Doctor didn't need to know anything of the previous episode. It didn't even need to happen. It almost seemed like, in many respects, they're like, hey, you know what, we're one episode shy of an idea. What one can we do that really isn't going to have a deep impact? You know, it didn't bring anything, unless episode 3 is somehow going to harken back to something that the Doctor remembers from the dream that he had of that particular episode that will help save the day. It doesn't hold any significance.
Yeah. Do you know what? You've just reminded me of something, actually, because I... you know, taking one for the team, as it were. I watched Extremis again.
I know.
And there was a familiar face in there which I hadn't noticed initially. I'm just looking up now. Oh, no, I can't find him now. But I did see a face that looked similar to, you know, in Father Ted, there's a priest who's depressed.
Yes.
I'm pretty sure that's the guy who was in the basement of the Vatican, who shot himself off screen later on. He did seem to have the same face.
Yeah, he's an Irish comedian, isn't he?
Yeah, yeah. I can't recall his name at the moment. That's why I've just been looking him up and I can't remember his name. So to hell with that. But it did seem to be him. It did seem to be his face, which I didn't notice the first time. But I'd watched that episode of Father Ted a couple of weeks ago. But anyway, aside from that, where were we?
Comments.
Yes. Comments on the Book of Faces. Yes. Phil Vernon believes it ended better than it began. All the worst elements of the last few years at the beginning. Doctor's President shtick is just unbearable. Nick Caulfield, one of our regulars there, says a lot of things, actually, which I would love to repeat most of, because it's all perfectly fine, and it's good opinion on Doctor Who over the past few years. But he ultimately agrees with the previous commenter that the ending was excellent. Turn off the cameras to see which gets turned back on. Very clever. It was. Colin Grigson, again, our one of our other regulars, slightly more enjoyable than last week's. There's a few things he doesn't understand. Why would human be at its weakest in 2017? Pretty sure we could have been easily dominated hundreds or thousands of years ago. Now, that's interesting. Because...
Yeah.
It might be, I mean, that might be a plot thing. It might be that these creatures haven't been, you know, around for a very long time at all.
Hmm.
Our truth monks. That they've maybe had a similar evolution to us, maybe, or travelled back from the future.
Or maybe something that happened in more recent times on Earth brought us to their attention, and they're not, maybe. They don't have time travel capability, kind of thought.
Indeed, yes. Now, unusually, I've been using Twitter to speak to our listener this week. Sorry, the monk who's been assigned to listen to us this week. And if I can just work out how to use Twitter on a tablet, I will be able to display the results of the poll. Do you think there is something more to the truth, monks? Yes, 33%. No, they're just truth monks, 67%. Now, what more could there possibly be to the truth monks, I hear you ask, dear listener / monk, who perhaps realizes that the game is up or is otherwise stroking his chin with mirth. Well, there's the tech for a start off. This is very high tech stuff. They're able to drop a pyramid. They're able to simulate an entire planet, which must require considerable processing power. They have blue lights all over the place and strandy things. They have the power to pull weapons and just drop them in the middle of the desert. And they also have the power to restore the Doctor's sight. What else? Oh, yeah, they can tap in to technology. They can tap into the security cameras. They have some ability to teleport, clearly, or appear in some way. And they also talk by opening their mouths and leaving their mouths open for the duration of the phrase that they're speaking.
Yeah, I've seen a few people make these sort of comments. I really do not like the idea of it going down that route, especially the opening of the mouth, because that wasn't really the point of the Cybermen.
It's the thing is, with all of those things there, though, that's a hell of a lot of coincidences. There's also the consent thing, which is not dissimilar to the final Eighth Doctor comic strip in Doctor Who magazine, which went on for about 4 or 5 months back in 2005, called The Flood, in which futuristic Cybermen travel back in time to conquer the Earth, but only... they would only do it if asked, and they kind of fold humanity into this world of terrible despair with despairing raindrops, hence the title of The Flood. I'm paraphrasing there, and it's been a long time since I read it, dear listener / truth monk, so I may have got some of that slightly wrong, but the point stands. So what my point is, there's so many coincidences with the Cybermen in there that, yes, it's nice to have a brand new villain at last on Doctor Who that has a compelling appearance and a mysterious modus operandi, and you know it's just good to have a new alien race. But at the same time, with so many coincidences linking them to the Cybermen, is that either intentional or is it really, really bad planning?
They can't win there, can they?
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's not a good idea either way. If they're intentionally trying to link them to the Cybermen, then they're kind of screwing up the Cybermen lore even more than it sounded like when Moffat said he was trying to fix it. Basically, it sounds like it's being messed up even further. And accidental, then it's just kind of like you're really running out of ideas. I mean, and in fairness, the whole race having to have consent to help Earth. That's even just an old vampire thing. You know, vampires once upon a time had to be invited into your home. Yeah. You know, they couldn't come in and kill you. They had to be asked in. You know, and it's just a play on that. And that sort of thing's okay. I mean, you know, the story concepts are being taken and evolved and borrowed and changed and twisted every day in every kind of medium, not just Doctor Who. And, you know, that sort of thing's okay. If you can find a good new twist on it, that's fine. But if it really goes to the point that this is connected to the Cybermen, which would make sense because we're halfway through the series, and that's generally the old format, introduce the big bad at the end of the series, at least midway through the series. Mm. I wouldn't want that. That's not how I want to picture the Cybermen. I mean, the one thing that gives me hope that that's not the case is the fact that the monks had talked about how they chose this form to look like humans. And then, you know, obviously they had that pretty cool, I thought pretty cool comment anyway, that, you know, you look like corpses. Well, you are corpses kind of thing. I thought that was kind of neat. Because that, to me, sets them apart from the Cybermen. They say they took that form to choose look like human, rather. But what we know of Mundas anyway is that the planet basically evolved like Earth did, you know. And I really still hope that the story that Moffat is choosing to go with is my story for connecting Mundas and the Russell T. Davis Cybermen and even Moffat's own Cybermen. But if it's these monks, that's not going to be it. That's not going to be good enough.
James?
Not for me.
I don't know. I mean, I just thought it'd be, when I saw it last night, I was thinking it'd be more interesting if they were some sort of branch of Time Lord. Mm-hmm. Since the Time Lords are sort of back. Yeah, that would at least carry some sense.
The robes
sense
as well.
Well, I try not to be
and the
so...
the technology as well.
It's the technology which was getting me. The technology is so ridiculously powerful. Their knowledge of the Doctor has to be potent for them. Because that's the only way you can explain extremists in the virtual simulation, apart from the fact that they're looking ridiculously for this weak point in time and space. Well, no, that is the reason, isn't it? Is that they're just looking for this weak point. But the amount of data that they extract is just beyond... it's ridiculous. I mean, the amount that they are, because they're mapping time and space essentially. And do they actually allude to that in this episode? Do they sort of suggest it's not just Earth? It's a greater. Or is that just me? Did I mishear that?
I'm not. I've only watched.
I don't.
Well, then that to me is because to me is insane. The level of technology is just so ridiculous to take this Earth. But then I suppose they have this thing that so far there seems to be something more ritualistic about where they need them to be.
I agree. There are similarities to the Time Lords. I don't think the consent thing quite works as well, and especially for the Cybermen, I don't think the consent thing works as well, considering it was only in a comic strip. And if you're going to introduce it now, it's new, and it doesn't make sense with everything else we know about them. But the one thing that, when I watched the story, I immediately thought that these monks were somehow connected to either the Time Lords or indirectly to the Time Lords via the John Sim master. And that was because here we have this great big pyramid appear out of nowhere, which, number one, is very TARDIS-like, that it can just appear from out of nowhere. And number two, it's very TARDIS-like for when you go back to Logopolis and the Doctor is explaining to Adric how the chameleon circuit works. And he shows, well, hey, you know, we wanted to be a pyramid. And I thought, could they be hearkening back to that to make some of us pick up on that, some of us old-time fans pick up on that.
Also,
that was something that I immediately thought when I saw that. I'm sorry, what was that, Christian?
I said also flashed through my mind. The Cybermen link I didn't pick up on until a few hours later.
Gotcha.
This just going back to the modus operandi, if it was the Cybermen wanting consent, in the comic strip The Flood, they did it that way because they tried to take Earth by force, and these were futuristic Cybermen who travelled back in time, because they'd failed to take the Earth by force so many times. They used that tactic.
But then I suppose you could argue that there is a logic to Cybermen, because when you give organs, you do have to give consent if you're an organ donor.
Mm.
So I wonder, maybe you're right. Maybe that's the root on this. The consent is organ donorship.
Yeah. What if these are... Okay, see, the Cybermen connection to me, I was thinking that these were pre-Mundas Cybermen. But what if these are post... everything. What if these are the Cybermen's eventual futuristic form, that they've abandoned cyber technology, but they are still made from technology, hence the fact that they said they made their bodies to look like humans? You know, maybe that's something. What if we're going to get a hint in this story of the future of the Cybermen? This way, when we get to the end of the series, we go back to see their beginnings on Mundas.
Maybe. Or maybe it's all just supposition.
Hopefully they stand on their own two legs as their own alien, because we need that. We need more. We need new ones.
We certainly do. Now then, I think it would probably be an opportune moment to wrap up our Doctor Who chat with...
opportunity.
Oh, what's that?
You just said it would be an opportune moment. I thought you were going to say, oh, well, it would be an opportune moment to end this session like Davros.
Oh,
sorry. You know, if you're doing Doctor Who podcast, man, quote Doctor Who. Sorry, go on.
Yes, ratings recap. Official ratings for Extreme is 5.53 million viewers in the UK, which places it at number 20 for that week, which isn't bad. It was, I think it was 20% of the viewing audience or so. It's not great. It's not top 10. What can you do? Pyramid at the End of the World had an audience appreciation index of 82, which I think is in tune with Extremists as well. And the overnights for Pyramid at the End of the World were 4.01 million, a share of 20 again. It was a funny day because it was the FA Cup final that day, which it kind of skews everything with television, but so that's that. So that brings us to the end of this week's podcast with a K. We are a combination of us. We'll be back next week. So until then, dear listener, sorry, Truth Monkey won't get a look in next time. It's goodbye.
This is a Beyond Casterbrus podcast. Available on iTunes, Audio Boom, Stitcher.com, Player FM, and BeyondCasterbrus.com.